Before I started working on this show, everything I knew about Watergate came from the movie All the President's Men. You've probably seen it. But do you remember how it ends? Woodward and Bernstein are sitting at their typewriters, clacking away. And then there's this rapid montage of newspaper stories about campaign aides and White House officials getting convicted of crimes, about audio tapes coming out that prove Nixon's involvement in the cover-up. The last story we see is Nixon resigns. It takes a little over a minute in the movie. In real life, it took about 2 years.
Five men were arrested early Saturday while trying to install eavesdropping equipment.
It's known as the Watergate incident. The Democrats are making an issue out of it.
The Republicans were fairly successful at making people think that the Watergate break-in was politics as usual.
What was it like to experience those 2 years in real time? What were people thinking and feeling as the break-in at Democratic Party headquarters went from a weird little caper to a constitutional crisis that brought down the president?
If you think of the whole thing as moving from a wellspring in the mountains to a stream to a river to all of a sudden this huge rushing gusher, at this point it was like a trickle.
As I found out, those 2 years were littered with incredible stories that have been all but forgotten. There's the story of Martha Mitchell, the wife of Nixon's first attorney general.
The break-in, that was the beginning of my being held a prisoner.
The story of Curtis Prinz, congressional staffer who was one of the first people to investigate Watergate.
It was at that time that I realized that this thing went directly into the White House.
The downfall of Richard Nixon was stranger, wilder, and more exciting than you can imagine.
Well, that's the introduction to Slow Burn, a hugely popular podcast now on Apple's list of top 10 podcasts dedicated to Watergate. The 8-episode podcast featured on Slate.com is hosted by Leon Neyfakh. Leon Neyfakh, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's interesting, you say there at the start that all you knew was what the movie All the President's Men had told you. And I guess that's pretty much the same for a lot of us on this side of the Atlantic. On the other hand, there's a lot of information out there about Watergate if you want to go digging and reading. How did you begin to tackle everything that was out there and bring it together in a podcast that I guess, you know, would work to become something that would be fascinating listening for listeners?
It's absolutely true that there's a mountain of material out there. Many books have been written and many documentaries have been made. When I was starting out, as you said, I knew quite little about the story beyond what's in All the President's Men. So I sort of tried to be efficient in my sort of early stages of research, which meant watching documentaries that kind of run through the story relatively quickly. And then from there, I read the sort of major tomes that have been published that are sort of seen as the kind of definitive accounts of the story. The one that I used most often was a book called Nightmare, which came out in the 70s, not long after Watergate ended, by a journalist named J. Anthony Lucas. That book was a great help. There were a couple others as well.
The greatest challenge of all of this, of putting the podcast together, what was the biggest challenge in doing it?
Well, so, you know, my initial hesitation about doing the show, and I did have a hesitation, was that, you know, the story's just been told so many times, so how are we going to make something new and fresh? And so part of the challenge was finding, you know, the right people to interview who are there and are still around, who remember enough and who are good enough at telling the stories that we wanted to tell on the show. You know, chasing down archival footage was always a challenge. You know, we relied a lot on NBC News archives. There were a couple other archives that were really helpful. But, you know, I think going back to that question of how do we make this fresh, my goal sort of every step of the way was to try to locate details and subplots and characters who have not been sort of canonized in the way that, say, Woodward and Bernstein were, or John Dean, you know, people who were important at the time and were quite well known at the time, but maybe haven't necessarily been remembered collectively in the same way.
And that brings me straight to Martha Mitchell. What a fascinating woman. What a fascinating episode. So let's talk a little bit about her. First off, I'm embarrassed to say I knew nothing about her. Explain who.
Don't be embarrassed. I didn't know.
Did you not? Okay. I don't feel so bad. Explain to our listeners who she was.
So Martha Mitchell was the wife of a man named John Mitchell, who was Richard Nixon's first attorney general, as well as his sort of number two. He was sometimes called the deputy president. In 1972, he ran Richard Nixon's reelection campaign. He had left the attorney general's office and taken over the organization that's now known as CREEP, which is an acronym that stands for the Committee to Reelect the President. And so Martha was his wife, and she kind of became a little mini celebrity in, I think, 1971 was sort of her breakout moment. She really became beloved, I think, and became quite a real character. You know, like people would have her on talk shows, and she would appear on game shows. She was very outspoken. Her image was that of a reckless gossip a little bit. She was sort of seen as someone who just ran off at the mouth and, you know, commented on things she probably shouldn't be commenting on.
Martha Mitchell has been on the phone again to the Washington Star News and to UPI.
Well, I just don't sit around and do nothing, I guess. I'm a doer. I'm always up to something. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, but I'm always up to something.
You know, she was quite, you know, obviously the fact that she was a woman plays a huge role in this. But basically, you know, the story that we tell in the first episode of the show is about how in the immediate aftermath of the Watergate break-in, she came to be seen by Nixon's kind of inner circle as a threat because, you know, she was very close to the action. She, you know, was in the apartment where John Mitchell was having meetings with people, and perhaps she overheard things they said. She was also known as an eavesdropper, by the way. So she was seen as a danger. And so in those first couple of days, the Nixon operation, I hesitate to say Nixon himself, had her essentially locked up. They basically sent an ex-FBI agent to go and to babysit her, sort of, and make sure she stays off the phone, lest she call someone such as a reporter, which she had a lot of reporter friends, and tell them what she knew about the Watergate break-in.
And what did her husband say about all of this, or what was his reaction? Did he agree with that action?
It seemed like it. I mean, he was. I think the best evidence we have for what his point of view was comes from a journalist named Helen Thomas, who was one of Martha's kind of go-to reporters when she was in the mood to chat with journalists. And when Martha Mitchell was sort of in captivity for those couple of days, she actually she managed to get Helen Thomas on the phone. And she was speaking to her and starting to talk about all the dirty business that the Nixon people were engaged in when the phone went dead. And it turned out that this ex-FBI guy who had been called in to monitor her had basically ripped the phone out of the socket so that she couldn't continue the call. And so when Helen Thomas realized this, she or at least realized that something was wrong, she called John Mitchell, Martha's husband, and asked him, you know, what the deal was, and he said something very dismissive. You know, it was, oh, you know, that sweetheart of mine, you know, I love her, but, you know, she gets upset sometimes, da-da-da-da-da. So, you know, he really kind of brushed it aside, and later, you know, they fell out quite dramatically and were separated before her death.
She did say in that interview with David Frost in 1974 that she was locked into a hotel room and sedated. Do we know?
That's right, yeah. I mean, that's...
Yeah, do we know that was true?
Yeah, we do. we know that she... I spoke actually to the doctor who was called in and who actually administered the injection. He didn't remember all the details, or at least he said that he didn't. But there are memos, you know, including from that ex-FBI agent who was minding her, that basically confirmed the outlines of the story. So, yeah, I think there's not a lot of doubt that this is what happened.
Of all the characters that you have met so far and we've heard on the podcast so far, whose story has been the most fascinating for you?
Well, so there was one story I used on the show that I returned to a lot in my own head, and that's concerning a assistant special prosecutor who worked for Archibald Cox. He was part of the prosecution team, and his name was Carl Feldbaum, and he told me the story of the Saturday Night Massacre, which is when Richard Nixon essentially fired his attorney general, or rather forced his attorney general to resign because he wanted him to get rid of the special prosecutor. Mm. And so Feldbaum told me the story about how that night he and his wife and two of their friends slash colleagues rushed to the special prosecutor's office because they'd been told that, you know, this their boss, Archibald Cox, had been fired, and that the FBI was on its way to the office to seal it off and possibly, you know, tamper with the evidence, who knows. And so Carl told me this story of how he and his wife and their two friends rushed over to the office, you know, beat the FBI there, got there right in time, and Carl had some specific pile of evidence that he wanted to protect, and he got out of the safe and gave it to his wife, who stuffed it in her pants and got on the elevator just as the FBI was coming out. And so she got downstairs into the car. And after that, you know, there was a standoff with the FBI. So that to me is sort of a almost like unthinkably dramatic series of events.
Yeah. You asked the question, if we were living through Watergate now, would we know it? What do you think?
I think it's always hard to evaluate, you know, how things will look in hindsight. I think I came to the conclusion that it feels quite similar now as it did then, and just in the sense that there are so many things happening at once, and they are kind of unrelated to each other, but they all are anyway, because they're happening simultaneously, and we have to process them all at once. So, you know, one good example is that Nixon's vice president Spiro Agnew was forced to resign right as Watergate was cresting, right at the very climax. He was forced to resign for an entirely separate scandal. It was involving a bribery scandal that dated back to his days as governor of Maryland. And so, you know, hearing that and imagining what it would be like to open the newspaper and see that the VP has resigned under pressure because of a bribery scandal while the Watergate fiasco is unfolding really kind of reminds me of what it feels like to read the news today.
Yeah. So. and as you said at the very start in the clip that we heard, you know, this all happened over a period of a few years, although the movie, you know, told us it in the space of 2 hours. How gripping was it for people at the time? If it's, you know, drip feed, like I guess we're getting now with the Mueller investigation, etc. You know, were people as gripped by it back then?
Oh, God, yeah, if not more. You know, so during the summer of 1973, there was this amazing spectacle on television every day in which the Senate Watergate Committee, which is made up of seven senators, questioned one after the other, you know, all manner of Nixon officials or ex-Nixon officials. And, you know, the testimony that was being presented was completely flooring to most people. The most sort of spectacular testimony came from Nixon's former White House counsel, John Dean, who essentially had turned on Nixon, decided to tell the truth about what happened during the cover-up, because even though he was one of the architects of the cover-up. And so, yeah, that summer, people were glued to their TVs. I mean, I've heard stories from folks who have written to me saying, you know, I remember my dad, we were on a road trip, and my dad wouldn't let us change the radio station because he wanted to hear every moment of this. And it was like a real part of the culture. I mean, there was the chairman of the committee was a guy named Sam Ervin, a very beloved figure because he was sort of seen as very decent, plain spoken, concerned with the law, not biased, and he was so popular that there was even a Sam Ervin fan club that was founded by someone who wanted to honor him and became very, very popular.
Well, it was, as you say, the gate that started all other gates. It is on the Apple Podcast Most Popular. Have you been surprised, by the way, at the huge response to it? Did you expect that it would take off, this podcast, the way it has?
No, I mean, I think it's been just a wonderful surprise to see people responding to it so positively. I'm not surprised that it's resonating. I mean, just because there are so many parallels between what's happening now and what happened then, but certainly the fact that we found the audience that we have has been just a delightful surprise that we could not have counted on.
Yeah. Well, it's entitled Slow Burn. It's featured on Slate.com. Check it out. Its host is Leon Neyfakh. And Leon, great to talk to you. The best of luck with it. And thanks so much for joining us
here
on the show. Cheers. You're tuned into The Green Room here on News Talk. We'll be back with you after this.